My name is Lori McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship associate for today's service. I'm joined in welcoming you by worship leader Mike Havancik, our director of music education, or our music director, Hal Walker, our assistant director of religious education, Colleen Teeley, and guest musician, Mark Alexander. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community. Alice, this morning, let us keep in mind the words of Charlie Chaplin. A day without laughter is a day wasted.
All right, I just learned this song, and it's got like twice as many words as most normal songs, so. So I hope you don't mind looking at the top of my head, because I'm going to be glued to this page here. Every indication is my spiritual foundation is on permanent vacation on the whole. Though death be drawing nearer, nothing's getting any clearer when I look into the mirror for my soul. Though up till now I've been a cynic and sarcastic to the core, my gray hairs make me hopeful that there may be something more. But when my heart starts evoking further scenes beyond my croaking, my old brain just thinks I'm joking like before. I believe there's nothing after life goes by. I believe it's over when we die. Others may be thankful their beliefs are strong, but every night I'm praying that I'm wrong. The trouble with my praying is I find it so dismaying that no one may hear me saying what I say. I should be a believer in a heavenly receiver, but I'm not sure of that either, by the way. And the problem with believing is you can't decide you do, not like how you decide you want to paint your kitchen blue. Plus, whenever I try kneeling, flinging questions towards the ceiling, I get echoes back revealing not a clue. I believe there's nothing after life goes by. I believe it's over when we die. Others may be thankful their beliefs are strong, but every night I'm praying that I'm wrong. Now some have a fixation on their next reincarnation and believe we're in rotation here on Earth. That right after we expire, we're reborn, a tubeless tire. Yet I hear myself inquire, what's it worth? For this idea that you return without your body or your mind, and return without a memory of the life you left behind, has my poor cerebrum churning, since the gaps within my learning leave exactly what's returning undefined. I believe there's nothing after life goes by. I believe it's over when we die. Others may be thankful their beliefs are strong, but every night I'm praying that I'm wrong. Some do think that later we'll be meeting our creator, that old prestidigitator in the sky. I did it. But if you talk to others, we'll be meeting with our mothers and our dear departed brothers by and by. If there be any truth to that, I had a dog I can't replace, and when I call old Hildy, she'll come licking at my face. Oh, it really would be super to rejoin that faithful trooper, so I'll bring my pooper scooper just in case. I believe there's nothing after life goes by. I believe it's over when we die. Others may be thankful their beliefs are strong, but every night I'm praying that I'm wrong. Every night I'm praying that I'm wrong.
have to follow that. When I was praying my call to worship for this Sunday, I was thinking, what could I say about laughter that's meaningful and spiritual and fits with the theme of the service and yet is not so spiritually heavy that we forget we're supposed to laugh? So I looked up some quotes about laughter, and I found a few that I thought were interesting. Milton Berle says, "Laughter is an instant vacation." Victor Borgia says, "Laughter is the closest distance between two people." Robert Frost said, "If we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane." And I found some fun UU jokes. Are you ready? Why don't UUs have church during the summer? God trusts them. What do you get when you cross a Jehovah's Witness with a Unitarian?
Someone who goes door to door and asks you about God.
You're very close. You're very close. I have someone who knocks on your door and asks you what you believe. Same idea. Very nice, Dan. How do you drive a Unitarian Universalist out of town? Burn a question mark on their front lawn. How does the Unitarian Universalist Association excommunicate members? Take away their coffee. How can you tell if a UU is having a good time? His mouth is moving. What do you get if you put two Unitarian Universalists together? Three opinions. And lastly, did you hear the latest UU miracle? Someone saw the face of Ralph Waldo Emerson on a block of tofu. Come, let us worship together. This morning's prayer will be a collaborative one. You will know when to speak. We gather this morning on the cusp of a new year. Sometimes this holiday brings joy, and to others, well, it can be challenging. Perhaps we look back on the year that we just spent and realized the resolutions that we made with so much hope did not come to pass. There are things we need to let go of, We need to let go of that failure. We need to let go of that pain. The things we need to let go of are
regret, fear, sadness,
the Congress,
inertia,
the government.
We need to let go of these things, yes, but we need not forget them. Because holding and remembering pain allows us to feel joy greater. And certainly, this new year, there are many things we wish to welcome into our lives. Things we want more of, not just money, not just stability, but those things that feed our soul. The things we want more of are
time with family and friends, music, peace,
balance.
Justice, unconditional love,
empathy, truth,
compassion, patience,
laughter,
consciousness,
as the wheel of the year turns again, let us be mindful of these things when they come into our lives. Let us remember to pause and see them and feel them and know, even though we are not perfect, that we can have more of these things in our lives if we but notice when they're there. May it be so, and amen.
Thank you.
able to lighten up is the key to feeling at home with your body, mind, and emotions, to feeling worthy to live on this planet. For example, you can hear the slogan, "Always maintain only a joyful mind," and start beating yourself up over the head for never being joyful. That kind of witness is a bit heavy. This earnestness, this seriousness about everything in our lives, this goal-oriented, we're going to do it or else attitude is the world's greatest killjoy. There's no sense of appreciation because we're so solemn about everything. In contrast, a joyful mind is very ordinary and relaxed. So lighten up. Don't make it such a big deal. When your aspiration is to lighten up, you begin to have a sense of humor. Your serious state of mind keeps getting popped. In addition to a sense of humor, a basic support for a joyful mind is curiosity, paying attention, taking an interest in the world around you. Happiness is not required, but being curious without a heavy judgmental attitude helps. If you are judgmental, you can even be curious about that. Curiosity encourages cheering up. So does simply remembering to do something different. We are so locked into this sense of burden, big deal joy, and big deal unhappiness, that it's sometimes helpful just to change the pattern. Anything out of the ordinary will help. You can go to the window and look at the sky. You can splash cold water on your face. You can sing in the shower. You can go jogging. Anything that's against your usual pattern. That is how things start to lighten up.
Welcome to the holiday hangover service. Odds are good that many of you spent the last week engaging in powerful spiritual services and rituals. I hope that it was beautiful and meaningful and that it gave you at least a glimpse into the divine fabric of the universe that connects us all. At the same time, I realize that many of you are probably religioned out at this point. It's in fact why we only have one service today. Only the most hardcore members of any congregation have any appetite left after gorging on the spirit all week. That's why any programming committee worth its salt tends to use this week to bring in speakers of limited interest to share services of minimal social and spiritual import. This sounds disappointing. I would argue that it's a good thing. Think of this as an opportunity. Did you know that nobody of any kind of authority or good sense even asked me what I was going to talk about today? This is our chance to do things you could never get away with in a normal church service. And remember that when people ask you what we talked about and what happened in today's service, you can always reply, "I'd rather not say." So we're down the rabbit hole now. Just imagine what we could do with this moment. We could do things that would result in new rules and bylaws. Can you imagine somebody joining this church in the future and having to ask, "Why is there a rule against naked chainsaw juggling at this church?" And somebody would have to say, "There was this after Christmas service 1 year." So today's service is about humor. In my mind, humor and religion go hand in hand. It's probably because I was raised in the Catholic Church. We went to a little church in the suburbs in the Midwest. The main priest was named Father Anderson. He was a flamboyant dresser. He wore long, flowing, colorful robes, big purple vestments with gold lamé trim. On special occasions, he wore this big, pointy Pope hat. So he stood up there week after week, looking like a roadside attraction in Mexico City. I always thought he dressed that way so he'd be easier for God to spot him from heaven. But I have to admit, even though he was a snazzy dresser, I did not find him to be interesting. In all fairness, I was a child, and nothing was interesting to me unless it exploded or was rolled in sugar. After services, all 500 of us would attempt to leave that narrow church parking lot at the same time. This is when reality would set in. It was a traffic jam of Catholics. That's biblical. That's like a plague of locusts, you know? People would be swearing at each other, cutting each other off, gesturing maniacally. I could not understand this behavior because our faith taught us that if you misbehave, you go to this cave-like place with fire, and these people, these red men with hooves, would poke at you with a pitchfork for all of eternity. I never understood that concept of hell. I always thought it would be more like North Dakota, but with more snow. Instead of demons, I imagined old men with snow shovels and those hats with the ear flaps, saying really obvious things like, "Sure is cold, isn't it?" Over and over again for all of eternity. Once we finally wrestled our way out of that parking lot, we're driving home, and my father quizzed the service. He says, "Well, son, what was the sermon about today?" And I didn't know because I never paid attention, but I learned how to bluff. So I'd say things like, "It's about how you better behave or Jesus will get you." And my dad would say, "Very good, you were paying attention." One time my dad asked me what the service was about, and I said, "You know, I don't remember. What was it about?" And my father said, "Well, it was about how you better behave or you'll go to hell." That's when I realized that none of us were listening to Father Anderson. It was an important spiritual turning point for me. My father attempted to correct this problem by getting me signed up for catechism class, which is where you would get up every Saturday morning and sit through these classes, learn about our faith. It was led by these horribly misinformed nuns who didn't seem to know a lot about the faith. They would tell us things with great conviction, but if we asked them a few questions, they would pretty quickly crumble. And I kind of suspected that they were really in charge of us as some sort of punishment. One day we went on a field trip into the sanctuary to come up to the altar and look at the different ritualistic objects up there. We got up there, and first thing I saw was a table with a box on it. And the box had red velvet curtains and a big gold cross on it. It looked really important. "What's in the box?" I asked. "God's in there," the nun answered. It might seem hard to believe that God is contained in a box on a table in the Midwest. But it really wasn't that much of a stretch. We believed in the parting of the Red Sea. We believed in a virgin birth. It was really just kind of right along the same lines. So this was exciting. God is in this box. I ran up to it to open the doors and actually get a look at God. "No, no, no," she said. "Don't do that. He'll get out." This immediately put two pictures in my head. One was of God in this as a sort of bird-like character who might come fluttering out of this thing and fly around. Well, I'd be trying to catch him, and he'd end up in the rafters somewhere. Maybe he'd end up getting eaten by a cat or something. The other picture put in my head was the thought of coming home, my father saying, "So, son, what happened in catechism class today?" And having to say, "Well, I let God out of the little box, and he flew around, and we tried to catch him, and he got eaten by a cat, and I'm really sorry." Because there is no amount of grounding that makes up for somebody's deity being eaten by a cat. So that church was not a good fit for me. I found more and more as I grew up how much they used that faith to censor others, to pass judgment. They also had a shameful attitude toward sex, which was something that I had interest in. So I came to the UU church. Actually, there was a period of happy, godless years wandering through the town here, but eventually bought a house, got married, started coming to this church. I became familiar with the sacred UU practices. the potluck, the petition, the committee. So that was when I made my conversion from organized religion to disorganized religion. So hopefully that gives you some context of the journey I've taken and how I connect religion and humor. The great writer E.B. White once said, "Humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind." And I think he's right, that when humor stops being funny when you analyze it, which is exactly what I'm prepared to do for the rest of our time together today. Like all significant things, humor could be used in good ways or bad ways. Some of the bad ways are, you know, denying truths, dismissing and judging others harshly. But for the most part, laughter is actually a wonderful thing. For example, the benefits for physical health are significant. When we laugh, it releases endorphins, which reduce pain. There actually are a bunch of studies that show that people who laugh often are significantly less likely to develop heart disease than people who don't laugh as often. Laughter lowers blood pressure, decreases stress hormones, increases infection-fighting antibodies, increases oxygen to the tissues, aids in digestion, eases in muscle tension. It's a great workout for several muscle systems, and hearty laughter is the equivalent of several minutes on the rowing machine or exercise bike. You're welcome. So that's the physical health. There's also mental and emotional health benefits to laughter and humor. Laughter increases our attentiveness, stimulates the brain to enhance learning, reduces psychological stress, helps us let go of anger, elevates mood. It increases objectivity and insight, so the problems seem less formidable. And then there's a spiritual element of humor. One example is Hatha Yoga. It's a type of yoga where people engage in deep breathing, physical exercise, and simulated laughter of various types, including hearty, silent, and dancing laughter. People who use this report that it enhances mental clarity, promotes a sense of well-being, and is instantly calming for them. Caution, if you're pregnant, have heart problems, or hernia, prolapse, uterus, or hemorrhoids, check with your family practitioner, gynecologist, or neuropathic doctor before embarking in this type of program. Anything about the seven principles of this faith? So many of them are about connecting, sharing, and creating, promoting positive social change. And that gets into the next area, which is how humor benefits social health. First is the interpersonal end. As the quote you heard earlier, laughter is the shortest distance between two people. It's a non-threatening way to communicate. Interesting thing happens. Laughter allows us to let go of rigidly held ideas, because by laughing, we're often acknowledging the absurdity of a point. And there are studies that show that couples who laugh together tend to stay together. So that's the kind of interpersonal end of the social, but there's also humor as a form of protest. A lot of the bad behavior in our society is conducted by taking awful things and wrapping them in boring information. As the songwriter Tom Waits once said, the large type giveth, and the small type giveth, taketh away. So often people take and wrap these things in impenetrable legalistic language. So for example, campaign finance law, hard to make sense of it. The whole mortgage crisis, nobody can even fully explain or understand how that happened or what it all meant and how we could prevent and predict those things. In fact, the 1,600-page budget that Congress just passed is loaded with that kind of thing, and there are one or two sentences that remove all of the protections that were just put in place to keep another banking meltdown from happening. And what we need is for people to find these things and find the humor in them and share them. This is what changes this. Comedy Central is very good at this. So there's that end. There's also humor as a form of protest. It's easy to dismiss protest as self-righteous or histrionic. It's an easy way to take an important point and to quickly put it away and ignore it, unless it's funny. Here are some examples of some protest signs I've seen recently. I couldn't afford a politician, so I made this sign. Due to recent budget cuts, the light at the end of the tunnel has been turned off. And this one's my favorite. Obama is not a brown-skinned, anti-war socialist who gives away free health care. You're thinking of Jesus. So that's protest. There's also counter-protest. Many of you have heard of the Westboro Church. They're the ones who hold up great big signs at funerals that say things like, "Thank God for dead soldiers," and other horrible, monstrous things. They count on people being offended and upset. They count on people showing up to yell at them because that's how they get media attention. So how do you protest someone like that without actually feeding their cause? Well, people have figured out how. They show up in large numbers, dressed like Star Wars characters or SpongeBob SquarePants or penguins. And they hold up even bigger signs that say things like, "I have a sign." "God hates kittens." "Build prisons on the moon." Confuses the message and makes the story about how funny the counter-protesters are instead of about the original story. Similarly, a neo-Nazi hate group in Charlotte, North Carolina, held a rally recently. Again, these are people who count on people being upset and yelling at them, and then they get media coverage. So instead of showing up and yelling, hundreds of people showed up dressed as clowns. They outnumbered the Nazis 5-1. And they mingled with them, mixed with them, and any time they said the word white power, the clowns threw flour into the air. So that by the end of the protest, the neo-Nazis were covered in white flour. The message to the neo-Nazis from the clowns: you look silly. The media is also a useful way to use humor to make positive change in society. I'll tell you about a project I'm working on. First, I have to let you know the issue. A recent study found that there are, at the very least, 5 trillion pieces of plastic floating in the ocean. That's 700 pieces of plastic for every single person on the planet. That's thought to be a very conservative estimate because that only counts for 0.1% of the world's annual production of plastic. In fact, there are the famous Pacific Ocean garbage patches, which are almost all plastic. And the most conservative estimate there is that the garbage island is the size of Texas. It's thought that if you count particulates and other things, that it's the size of the United States. Marine animals are eating this plastic, which means that we will soon be eating this plastic. So in the middle of this, AT&T started sending out these 4-inch by 8-inch plastic promotional cards, thick as a credit card, promoting their U-verse program. There was no reason to promote that program on plastic. You could just as easily put it on recyclable cardboard. And on the card was a picture of people gleefully running through the surf. So I scanned it, put it on Photoshop, and put many, many, many little AT&T logos floating through the water and in the air. And I had the lead guy running through the surf saying, "Let's get out of the water before we're completely enveloped in AT&T's plastic garbage." And put that on Facebook, along with an article on the dangers of plastic in the ocean. It's my hope that the humor will carry that message much further than if I just wrote a self-righteous diatribe about the dangers of plastic in the ocean. There's also a television program called State of Myths, and it airs on Iraqi television, and it takes on religious extremism with slapstick and puns. It's another way to use humor to challenge unacceptable things. And as we do the post-mortem study of what happened with Arab Spring, there are many now books and articles and seminars on the use of humor in making that a success. Humor through radio broadcast, graffiti, social media, and word of mouth. So the Great big message when we talk about social change is that corporations and government own large pieces of the media, large pieces of every kind of infrastructure out there, and billions and billions of dollars. But we have 7 billion people who just may start talking to each other. And we're more likely to talk to each other if we have something funny to say. So in conclusion, humor is not the only tool, but it's an essential tool for good mental health, good physical health, good social health, good spiritual health. And this is the point in the service where usually the speaker has some really profound statement that pulls together all of the ideas discussed in the service and leaves you with some kind of great inspirational line that you can repeat to yourself over and over again throughout your week and be nourished by it. I haven't come up with anything like that. I thought about it. So instead, we're going to end with a laughter exercise. And Hal will lead that for you.
Well, as someone who's not, doesn't generally distrusts people who are laughing too loud and needs extra practice laughing, I thought that we would do a little laughter training. And I'm going to be asking for volunteers. I'd like to hear some different versions of laughter, and then that we can respond to them, and then we'll just do a little laughing together. So I'll begin. I'm going to laugh, and then you sort of listen, and then try to imitate my laughter. Who else would like to try?
Wonder what the neighbors are thinking right now. What kind of church is this? Let's wrap up before the police arrive.
The emotions that I feel during these services are, they run the spectrum. On Christmas Eve, I was here doing the service with Melissa in tears, and a different kind of tears, and today I have tears of laughter. So in gratitude for all of the emotions that we can feel here together, the offering will now be gratefully received. If you are a guest with us this morning, there's a candle in a basket as our token of gratitude for you.